Okay, so we continue with the singularity theorems. And let me remind you of the singularity theorem that we discussed, or that I presented at the very, very end of the previous lecture. So the assumption here is that we have a space-time which is globally hyperbolic. And we assume that the energy momentum tensor obeys the strong energy condition. Strong energy condition takes this form. So this particular contraction of the energy momentum tensor and its trace with arbitrary time-like vector fields should be positive. What that means, we will discuss a little bit later. But just to anticipate, first of all, this is, through the Einstein equation, the Ricci tensor. So therefore, this energy condition, yes, it's a condition on the energy momentum tensor, but it's really also a condition on the curvature. And it's perhaps best to interpret it in this way. Because actually, it's not a particularly natural condition, as we will later see. It's a condition that's simply exactly what's needed in order to be able to prove the theorem. So unlike the weak or dominant energy conditions, which are quite plausible about positivity of the energy density, for example, the strong energy condition is mostly motivated as being the condition needed to be able to prove a singularity theorem. Further, an assumption here is that there exists a twice continuously differentiable space-like Cauchy surface sigma on which the trace of the so-called extrinsic curvature K, which we will study in more detail a little later, is bounded from above by a negative constant C. And what all of this means is that we are assuming that the space-time has a certain minimum amount of either expansion or shrinkage, so that we can then later prove everywhere, so that we can later prove that this expansion or shrinkage leads to either a big crunch in the future or a big bang in the past. Under these assumptions, the singularity theorem then claims that no past-directed time-like curve from a space-like, or from that space-like hypersurface sigma, can have an eigentime or proper length larger than 3 over this constant C here. This is regarding the existence of a Big Bang, but under similar conditions, we can also predict the unavoidability of a big crunch. So the claim is that all past-directed time-like geodesics are incomplete, because none of them can have a proper length larger than this. So they are incomplete, they can't be extended there, but it's not for lack of parametrization, but they just can't. And this means, according to our definitions, the incompleteness of these geodesics means that there is a cosmological singularity in the finite past. Or, if we turn the time, if we reflect t to minus t, then it can also indicate the presence of a cosmological singularity in the future. So the conditions here are talking about the so-called extrinsic curvature. What is this? Well, the extrinsic curvature of a space-like hypersurface describes not how much curvature there is between the x and the y direction. It's not a spatial kind of curvature. No, the extrinsic curvature is the curvature that exists between a space-like hypersurface and the time direction. And if you remember, we discussed that briefly earlier, namely that space-time curvature comes in two forms. There is curvature that's space-space curvature, that's the curvature that we intuitively have in mind when we think of a curved surface. And the sum of the angles in a triangle not being 180 degrees. But there's also the curvature which exists between space and time. And that curvature is expansion or shrinkage. And that's captured by the by the extrinsic curvature. So in particular, assuming that the extrinsic curvature k is smaller than a certain amount means that the space-time has at every point in the space like hypersurface, for example, means that the space-time at every point of that hypersurface, of that Cauchy surface, has a finite minimum expansion rate. So what that means is that we are looking at the space-time, for example, it could be today. We take this, a space like hypersurface, which is roughly speaking today. I mean, there are many ways that we can create, that we can define space like hypersurfaces that go through like events here and now. But any one of those will do. And then the assumption is that everywhere today we have a certain minimum amount of expansion rate. Or what that means is that, of course, in the future there should be expansion and in the past there should be shrinkage. If we can bound that, then you can see how that shrinkage can lead intuitively, we'll have to go through the math, but how that shrinkage, following things back in the past, how that shrinkage can indicate a shrinkage to zero, the existence of a singularity. However, it will be important that these conditions here are met. And one of those conditions is the strong energy condition. You see, just because the space-time is expanding now and has been shrinking in the past doesn't necessarily mean that in the past there has been a Big Bang. For example, at the Sitter universe, which is completely cosmological constant dominated, where the energy-momentum tensor consists only of a cosmological constant, well, then we know what the solution is. It's an exponential scale factor. But an exponential scale factor means that, yes, the universe is expanding in an accelerated way, and in the past, towards the past, it shrinks in a decelerating way, but it always decelerates, never reaching size zero. And indeed, if you plug in here for T mu nu, if you plug in G mu nu times the cosmological constant, then it's not fulfilled. Right? So if the cosmological constant were to be dominant, then the conditions of the theorem don't hold. And we will later specify more accurately what we mean by it is dominant.
Is that the same idea for the example you gave where there's net angular momentum and then when you shrink back it...
A little bit, yeah. It's just that, you know, just because something shrinks doesn't mean that it shrinks to a point. It could just keep shrinking, but more and more slowly and never quite reaching zero. Now, with the angular momentum and the ice skater who is spinning, there it would be the angular momentum that puts up a potential barrier. But in the case of the cosmological constant, it's an effect independent of the angular momentum, but with the same outcome, namely that it avoids a singularity. Okay, so we're assuming here that the space-time has, on that space-like hypersurface, a certain minimum amount of expansion. And then we have to rely on the Einstein equation and the Raichaudhuri equation that comes from it in order to, you know, keep, without solving the Einstein equation explicitly, to put bounds on what can possibly happen and from that derive then a singularity, the existence of a singularity. Okay, so we talked about that minimum amount of expansion rate that we want to have everywhere to start with at a Cauchy surface. And we have the strong energy condition. So let's look at the strong energy condition again. Remember first the weak energy condition. Weak energy condition says that if we contract the energy momentum tensor with any time-like vector v, then this should be larger than zero. Meaning that if we go to the rest frame of that observer, I mean, we can always go. We can always go into a coordinate system where the v mu is just minus 1, 1, 1, minus 1, 0, 0, 0, or 1, 0, 0, 0, the tangent vector. In fact, 1, 0, 0, 0, I mean, the length is the same for both vectors. And that means it picks out, this condition here just picks out the 0, 0 component if we are in the rest frame of the traveler v that has this time-like velocity here. And what that means is that this condition means that in the rest frame of an observer, the energy density, namely that's the T0-naught component, the energy density better be positive. Okay. Now, yes, that's what I wrote here. Now, there is also the dominant energy condition. And the dominant energy condition is the weak energy condition. And in addition, also the condition that the length of this vector, k mu, k mu, which is defined as the contraction of the energy momentum tensor with the velocity vector, is time-like. I mean, that this is negative, right? So that this is time-like. And remember what that contraction is. T mu nu contracted with v nu is the vector that points in the direction of the flow of energy and momentum. In particular, we showed that this vector is a conserved, describes a conserved quantity if we have a killing vector field, right? If v is a killing vector field, then k mu is covariantly conserved. Now, the dominant energy condition doesn't require that this flow vector k mu is actually conserved. But what it does require is that it is not space-like, which means that the energy and momentum might not be conserved, but the flow of the energy and momentum better be on or within the light cone. That's the dominant energy condition. But then, what about the strong energy condition? That's the one that we want for our theorem here. Matter is said to obey the strong energy condition if, and only if, this condition is fulfilled for all time-like tangent vectors. Now, what's the intuition here? As we will later see, if this condition is fulfilled, then it means that the energy momentum tensor is such that we do not have inflation. This condition means that the spacetime is not accelerating its expansion. And we had that earlier, if you remember, that it means that the W parameter, this condition means that the W parameter is larger than minus a third. Because if the W parameter, remember that was energy density over, that was pressure over energy density, if that was minus a third or below, then we have accelerated expansion. Then we have a horizon, a cosmological horizon. And so that condition, that this is larger or equal to zero, translates for an energy momentum tensor that can be described as a perfect fluid with an energy density and a pressure. For those, it means that this W parameter is larger or equal to is larger than minus a third, so therefore we do not have acceleration. And the point about the acceleration is that backwards in time it's a deceleration. See? And if we have this deceleration, then it could be that the universe towards the past keeps shrinking, all right? But the shrinkage keeps, decaying, and so it's slowly and slower, but it never actually, never, ever in the past hits size zero. So we want to avoid the deceleration in the past. Or if we are looking after a big crunch, in the future universe might recollapse and we want to show that there's a singularity at the end of that, then it's about the deceleration into the future. Now, is this a plausible condition? Well, kind of. This condition is obeyed by all matter that we know of. Which is also why there is no matter that we know of of the regular kind that could possibly create an inflation. There is just one field that can do it, and that is a scalar field, the inflaton field, but only if you give it a particular potential. That potential can do that. It can act temporarily like a cosmological constant. Now, what is the relationship of the strong energy condition to the weak and the dominant energy condition? I mean, the relationship between the weak and the dominant is easy to see. The dominant energy condition is the weak energy condition plus an extra condition. Now, so the strong energy condition implies the weak, but the weak doesn't imply the strong. Now, the dominant implies the weak, but the weak doesn't imply the dominant. And it turns out that the strong energy condition is independent of both of those. So you can't prove from this either the weak nor the dominant energy condition, neither can you do it the other way around. It's an independent condition. Let's briefly look at what it means concretely if we write this down in actual matrix elements. So for the known kinds of energy momentum tensors, so for the known kind of matter, the energy momentum tensor is always diagonalizable. And when we diagonalize it, then we have an energy density here and we have three principal pressures, usually assumed to be the same, but for the sake of generality, let's call them P1, P2, P3. Of course, if things were non-isotropic, then they could be actually different from another. Now, what are the three energy conditions again? Well, we have the weak energy condition, which, as we know, which means that the energy density is positive for an observer in their rest frame. But what if we do not go into the rest frame of the observer? If we do not go into the rest frame of the observer, then the vector v still is time-like, but now it has not only a zero component, it also has the 1, 2, and 3 components, and therefore this condition, the weak energy condition, also involves the pressures. And what it means is that not only is the energy density larger than zero, but it also means that the energy density plus each of the pressures is always larger than zero. I'm just saying that for completeness. Now, the dominant energy condition requires not only the weak energy condition, but in addition also that the energy density is larger than the absolute value of the PI, which is a slightly more stringent condition than that. And remember that pressures can be negative. A cosmological constant produces a negative pressure. Now, the strong energy condition can also be expressed, of course, in terms of rho and the principal pressures. And expressed in those terms, the strong energy condition is that the energy density plus all three of the principal pressures has to be larger than zero. And that's a more stringent condition than that one, for example. But also that the rho plus pi is larger or equal to zero, which we have here. Okay, so now let me remind you that the cosmological constant can be viewed as a contribution to the energy momentum tensor. Traditionally, it used to always be thought of as part of the gravity side, and that's the natural place where it occurs. If you remember from Sakharov's derivation of the Einstein action as arising from quantum fluctuations of fields, from the renormalization of fields, there the cosmological constant arises dominantly, really, from the same source as the Einstein action arises. But on the other hand, we can just put it on the other side of the Einstein equation, and then it's part of the energy momentum tensor. And if we put it there, then we see that a large lambda can spoil the strong energy condition. And then I leave it to you as a little exercise to show that the strong energy condition is violated in cosmology exactly if and only if this W parameter, so the ratio of pressure to energy density, is smaller than minus a third. That is to say, exactly if the expansion is accelerating, and therefore in the past is decelerating. (Clears throat) So what we are now aiming to show is that given the strong energy condition and the Einstein equation, one can show, and the geodesic equations, one can show that geodesics meet a divergence in a finite proper time in the back, in the past. They meet a divergence. And what exactly is that divergence? How do we see, in terms of geodesics, that they hit a singularity? What is that divergence? And what we will do there is we will calculate a quantity that is called the expansion. And for that, we consider geodesics that initially are very close together, so they are almost the same initial conditions. And then we will see how, over time, they either, you know, close by geodesics might either go further away from another or they might get closer to another. And this drifting away of geodesics or the convergence towards another of geodesics, that can be described through a quantity called the expansion. And what we will find is that under the conditions for this theorem, we have divergent expansion in the past. So what that means is that this theorem implies not only that there was a Big Bang in the sense that geodesics started there, there was a singularity. No, it also says that not only did the geodesics start there, no, they were also ripped apart with infinite rate of expansion. So that the rate at which geodesics parted from another singularity at the Big Bang was infinite. Now, the behavior of geodesics is really more complicated. They can not only drift away from another or converge towards each other, they can also spiral around each other. If you have a ring of geodesics, so let's say you create, you know, how are they called, these pasta that are hollow? What are they? Macaroni are the curved ones, right? But in any case, you know, this hollow spaghetti. Imagine you create a laser beam that's in that form, right, with a hole in it. Okay, then what can happen there? Well, what can happen is that the spaghetti of light might get thinner, right, smaller radius. It might also get bigger radius. But in principle, it could also just rotate, that each one of these laser beams goes to a different angle in this spaghetti. But also the spaghetti could become an oval, right? It could expand in one direction and contract in the other direction and so on. All of that can happen, and we will have to take care of all of these phenomena. And one of them is the expansion. And that's the one that you're really after in order to prove that there was a singularity. I mean, if there was a singularity, right? Because we know that we have a cosmological constant that's dominant now. We know that, well, we have good indications that there was cosmic inflation, in which, at the very beginning of the universe, in which, again, something like a cosmological constant was dominant, namely because of the inflaton field. And it's not clear whether actually before inflation there might have been a phase in which a strong energy condition was fulfilled, and we can actually conclude that the universe really had a beginning. It all depends on how inflation started. But without inflation, we would probably... it's completely hypothetical. Inflation is... We have good evidence for it. So we do that as a theoretical exercise, and we will later do also the Hawking... the black hole case, modeled roughly after this. Okay, so we are interested in the expansion. For this purpose, let us consider what is called a congruence of time-like geodesics. In other words, a hollow spaghetti. But not just a hollow spaghetti, that will be a special case of it. So let's consider a congruence of time-like geodesics through a space-like hypersurface sigma. And what that means is it's a smooth family of time-like geodesics. So you pick your space-like hypersurface. And remember, That's a three-dimensional thing. We call it surface, but that's because it's lower than 3 plus 1 dimensional. So we pick a space-like hypersurface, and then from every point, we send off time-like geodesics. So it's like we take a water pistol and we shoot in all directions at the same time. Okay, so then in free space, right? And we start a geodesic, exactly one of them at each point of the space-like hypersurface. So you pick a point of the space-like hypersurface, you shoot off a geodesic, and then you pick another point, a neighboring point, shoot off a geodesic, and the whole thing is supposed to be smooth. Now, we can choose this, space-like hypersurface to go from one point to the other, to the next point on the space-like hypersurface through a space-like geodesic as well. Now, we parameterize these time-like geodesics by their proper time, which we can do because they're time-like geodesics, so they have a proper time, and that's how we can parameterize them. Then we have a tangent vector field in the space-time, because at every point in space-time, one of those geodesics there will... for every point of the geodesic, we have a tangent vector, and together they form a tangent vector field psi. And that tangent vector field psi is actually d by d tau, because it's the, it's the derivative. It's a time-like vector field, and it is the differentiation with respect to the proper time. Since it is time-like, it has length minus 1. It's negative. It's 1 because we actually choose the proper time. Now, let's consider a one-parameter subfamily of these geodesics. So now we are going in the space-like hypersurface along a space-like path, along a geodesic space-like path, and we parameterize that path by a parameter S. So S is parameterizing neighboring geodesics, and tau is parameterizing the proper time on each one of these geodesics. Then we can define analogous to psi, which is the vector field that is time-like and points in the direction of the geodesic. We can also define a vector field eta, which is space-like and points from one geodesic to the next one, space-like, its space-like neighbor. So the psi vector field points along the geodesic, and the eta vector field points to the next geodesic. So here is our congruence of time-like geodesics, and here we have a space-like hypersurface, and the cut through this could be through through a space-like geodesic. Now what we want to know is this phenomenon here, that geodesics get closer to each other or get further away from another. And what that means is that we need to see how that vector field eta behaves. Right? So we have an eta vector here, we have an eta vector there, and it always points from a point on this geodesic to a point at the neighboring geodesic. And if, for example, the geodesics were to rotate around each other, then that eta vector field would reflect that by rotating around. If they go further away, the eta vector field gets longer. If they approach the geodesics, then it gets shorter. All right, so how does eta, the vector field eta, change along the geodesic? That tells us what the geodesics are doing. Are they approaching? Are they dancing around each other? Are they going away from another? So now the variables, we have two variables here. We have tau and S. Tau parameterizes the time-like geodesics this way. S parameterizes the space-like geodesic that way. And together at every point here, we can use them as the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system. And what we therefore have is that d by d tau, d by ds is d by ds, d by d tau. That is to say that these vector fields commute at each of these points. And now let's remember that this is a useful thing to know in the absence of torsion, I mean, in the absence of torsion, we can conclude something from the commutativity of two vector field. Namely, remember that the torsion tensor is defined as the covariant derivative, the torsion tensor of two vector fields is, of course, intuitively, it tells us by how much a parallelogram doesn't close a parallelogram that's spanned by xi and eta. But mathematically, what it is that the covariant derivative of eta in the xi direction minus the covariant derivative of xi in the eta direction minus the commutator of the two is vanishing. That's the absence of torsion, right? This would be the torsion, but the torsion is assumed vanishing. So we have this. Since we also have in this case that these two vector fields, the one along the geodesic and the one from geodesic to geodesic, have commuting tangents, we have that this expression is equal to zero, which is to say that that covariant derivative is equal to this covariant derivative. Now let's spell that out, what that means. The covariant derivative of eta in the direction of xi is the covariant derivative of the vector field eta. These are the coefficient functions, which are scalar, and these are the basis vectors. And then remember that the xi mu could be written down here, but we can always just pull that out of the covariant derivative. That's just picking out the direction in which we differentiate. And that's equal to the covariant derivative of xi in the eta direction. So in the eta direction, we are covariantly differentiating the vector xi. Now, the covariant derivative, let's see, how does that evaluate? Just to remind you, I mean, in principle, we've seen this many times. The covariant derivative in the mu direction of the eta vector field, when the eta vector field is spelled out as coefficient functions times basis vectors, then the covariant derivative has two jobs to do by the product rule. It differentiates this scalar coefficient function, and it also covariantly differentiates the basis vector. Remember what happens when you do a covariant derivative of a scalar function like this coefficient function. It's the ordinary derivative. And then we also have a term where we have the covariant derivative of the basis vector. What's that? That's the Christoffel symbol, right? Covariant derivative of one basis vector in the direction of the other basis vector, that's Christoffel symbols times e. And the coefficients here, I mean, if we evaluate that, that gives us two terms, right, from the product rule. It's the ordinary derivative of these coefficient functions plus the Christoffel symbols here. In other words, it's the covariant derivative also written as a semicolon. Okay, so it's xi mu, eta nu, semicolon nu. And the same thing on the right-hand side, just with eta and xi exchanging their roles. Right. Now, that has to be true for all, I mean, we can compare basis vector by basis vector. And therefore, we see that these coefficient functions have to be equal to these. Now, the xi vector's covariant derivative in the alpha direction, that xi nu covariant derivative in the alpha direction, that's something that has two indices. Let's give it a name. And we just call this B with an upper and a lower index. You see, this is a one-fold contravariant, and this is one contravariant, it's one covariant index. So what we have is that this is actually the covariant derivative of this tangent vector gives us a 1-1 tensor, one-fold covariant, one-fold contravariant tensor. So that's just a definition. And all of the information that we are looking for is actually encoded in that matrix. Remember what the information is that we're looking for. It's this. What's the covariant derivative of eta in the xi direction? So how does eta change in the xi direction? As we go along a geodesic, the vector field that points to the neighboring geodesic, how is that changing? And it's changing by that, right? Because here we have the covariant derivative, that's this, and on the right-hand side we have that. So you plug in a tangent vector, like the one to the right to this one, or here you might want to plug in that to that one to that one, and then you apply that to this matrix and you get how the eta changes. So the B tensor field tells us you know, it encodes everything. It encodes the lengthening of the eta vector if they move apart from another, the geodesics. It includes the shrinkage of the length of the eta vector if the geodesics get closer to each other. It can also be a rotation or a Lorentz transformation. All of that is in the B. So along the geodesics direction psi, the deviation vector eta that points to the neighboring to a neighboring geodesic changes its direction and length by this amount. So the tensor B nu mu describes everything: shear, rotation, expansion, shrinkage. In order to separate what it does, the various things that it can do, we will decompose it in a covariant and unique way. Namely, first of all, let's pull this index down so that we have two democratically equal indices here. And then we say, this thing may not be symmetric. It may not be anti-symmetric. It could have both components in it. So let's write it as a sum of something symmetric and something anti-symmetric. So we write it as the sum of an anti-symmetric tensor plus a symmetric tensor. So this is the symmetric part, and that's the anti-symmetric part. So for example, the anti-symmetric part obviously can be written down immediately. It's just literally the anti-symmetric part of B. The symmetric part, though, we don't just write it as the rest, which we could do. We could simply say, OK, the symmetric part is just this minus the omega. Easy. But we will decompose the symmetric part into two components, because what we're after is the expansion. Okay? And it's not the case that the symmetric part is just cleanly the expansion. It contains more than that. So we will do a decomposition here where this is the anti-symmetric part. And then the symmetric part we split into two pieces. The first piece is a tensor that is symmetric and whose trace is vanishing. Trace means the contraction with the metric is vanishing. And that is whatever remains then. So this is a traceful tensor. Obviously, the anti-symmetric part doesn't have a trace. The symmetric traceless part doesn't have a trace by construction. That's the only part that has a trace. And the trace is important because the trace is the only thing that can actually make an expansion or a shrinkage. Everything else is doing something else. And we will see in a moment what it does. So we take these two components, the sigma and the t, to split the symmetric part into two components, to two parts. So what are they? And that's going to be a little tedious, but it's not too bad, I hope. OK, so in preparation for this decomposition here and to analyze exactly what is the expansion, what is the drifting away of geodesics or the convergence of geodesics, perhaps even that they crash into another, and that's what we want to prove the existence of a singularity. So in preparation for that, we define a projector H mu nu, which will do the following. It will project onto the orthogonal complement to the time-like vector field that we have here. So you see, the geodesics are all time-like, and then there are vectors that are orthogonal to the geodesic. Let's project onto that. So whenever we have a vector or a tensor, then in principle it can have components that point in any arbitrary direction. We want to be able to project out all the time-like parts that we are just left with what's orthogonal to that time-like part. And so we define now a projector H mu nu, which projects onto the orthogonal complement of this direction, the direction of the geodesic motion. And that projector is a different projector at every point, and it's defined to be the metric tensor plus psi nu, where this is the geodesic vector here. Now, why would that be actually the projector onto the orthogonal complement to the time-like direction psi? Let's see. So we take about supposed projector? You see, this doesn't look much like a projector, but we'll have to see, right? So we take this thing and we apply it to a tangent vector. Arbitrary tangent vector W nu. So we apply this projector to it, so we contract these indices and we get a vector out of this. And that vector, the claim is, that vector is orthogonal to Xi. And that's the claim. So whatever vector we plug in here, what we get out is orthogonal to Xi. So let's check that. We take this vector here, so HW, that's the vector. And now we calculate the inner product with the Xi. And we want to see whether that's zero. Well, let's see what it is. The H is this. So we sub that into here. And then what we get is one term where we have the g mu nu. So we have Xi, g mu nu, w. That's this. It's just the inner product of Xi with w. But then we also have a time, we also have a term where this is subbed into here. So we have Xi, that's the length, Xi squared. And then we have a w Xi term. So we have Xi. Xi is a unit length time-like vector, so its length squared is minus 1. And then we have the Xi w. So we have Xi comma w minus Xi comma w is equal to 0. So yes, the outcome of applying this operator onto a vector is actually producing a vector that's orthogonal to Xi. Of course, we would also have to show that if you do that again, you still get the same vector, right? The projector has also to have the property that if you apply it twice, you get the same result. I leave that up to you to prove that. Okay, so now we want to define the so-called expansion. And the expansion, we will get to its meaning in a moment, but for now, the expansion theta is defined mathematically as the magnitude of the spatial part of B. So what that means is we apply our projector, the spatial projector, onto that matrix B, and we get a number out of that. Remember, B was that matrix that tells us for every eta vector what happens to it as we go along the geodesic. Right? This matrix B encodes rotations and shrinkages and shearing, turning you know, a circle into an oval, into an ellipse, and things like that. So we define this scalar here. Obviously, this is a covariant tensor, that's a covariant tensor, the whole thing is a scalar, and that scalar is called the expansion. We call it the magnitude of the spatial part of B because it is the trace of B. Now let's see whether that is true. So we have that theta is by definition this contraction here. And we know h mu nu explicitly. It's defined as this combination. So therefore, this contraction is actually the contraction of B with G and the contraction of B with Xi B. And this is by definition what we mean by the trace of a matrix. Namely, we just contract it completely with the metric. So that's the trace of a two tensor, it's just its contraction with the metric. And then we also have here this combination. We have Xi nu, B mu nu, and Xi, this contraction here. And what is that? Well, here we have the covariant derivative of the Xi vector in the direction of the Xi vector. But since Xi is the tangent to a geodesic, and a geodesic is orthoparallel, we have that this is vanishing, right? Along a geodesic, the covariant derivative of the tangent vector in the direction of the tangent is vanishing. So therefore, it's just a trace. Okay, so this means the following. This means that sigma mu nu, remember, we have this decomposition here. We write the b mu that contains all the information about rotations and shrinkages and drifting apart of geodesics. We write this, if you remember, as an anti-symmetric tensor plus a symmetric tensor, which we decompose into a traceless part and a trace full part. And so what we can now tell is that the traceless part of the symmetric part is given by the symmetric part minus the trace full part. It's 1/3 theta mu nu because the trace produces a number 3 here. Because if you calculate the trace of h mu nu with h mu nu, or indeed h mu nu with g mu nu, it doesn't make a difference. If you calculate that, you could just get, you know, the spatial part has 3 dimensions, and then each one of them gives you a 1. So that's in total then a 1. So we obtain the traceless symmetric part by taking the full symmetric part of B and then subtracting the trace. So overall then, we can write now all the 3 terms. We have the omega, which is the anti-symmetric part. So we write B as the sum of the anti-symmetric part plus the symmetric traceless part, which is this, the sigma, and then the T mu nu part, which is the expansion alone. So it's just the trace full part that is here. That's just the 1/3 of the theta H mu nu. Okay, so what do the 3 terms now mean physically? Well, omega mu nu is anti-symmetric. And if you remember, if you have a 2-fold covariant anti-symmetric tensor, and you apply that to some vector, to some vector field, then you are rotating that vector field. Or more generally, because this is relativity, you are actually performing an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. So what the omega mu nu does is that it Lorentz transforms that vector. However, all those eters are actually, remember, they're space-like, they're all orthogonal to the time direction. And what that means is that, yes, in principle, there are Lorentz transformations, but because everything happens spatially, it means that this is actually rotations. These are actually spatial rotations. So what the omega does is it takes this eta vector and it just rotates it. That's literally a rotation. It's as if the spaghetti was to be, you know, rotate, I mean, just, I don't know, twisted. And so we call omega mu nu the twist tensor. It turns out that actually these twists are not sort of natural. You can actually gauge them away. And exactly what you need to do to get rid of this twist tensor is that you only need to choose that your congruence of geodesics is actually starting orthogonally to the Cauchy surface sigma that you use to send your geodesics off. In principle, we didn't assume that. We didn't assume that the geodesics were sent orthogonally to the sigma. But if you do, then this twist tensor is actually vanishing. It's not easy to see, but you can find that in, for example, in a textbook by Straumann that is in our references. Okay, so that's the omega. It's the anti-symmetric part. Now, what does this symmetric part do? The symmetric part cannot be chosen away, cannot be made to vanish in general. So the symmetric part, the sigma mu nu is the symmetric traceless part. And by a suitable choice of bases, we can diagonalize it. And the sigma mu nu changes the relative lengths of the basis vectors by multiplying them with the eigenvalues of the sigma. And therefore, what starts out as a sphere, for example, or as a circle, will become an ellipse or an ellipsoid. Now, in principle, when we had the omega, this was generating infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. And you remember how you go to finite Lorentz transformations? You exponentiate, right? So you can exponentiate these infinitesimal generators of Lorentz transformations, and then you get finite Lorentz transformations. Similar with the sigma, that's a symmetric matrix. If you exponentiate that, then you can have that. Not only do you infinitesimally deform a sphere or a circle into an ellipsoid or an ellipse, but you can actually get a finite change into an ellipsoid. But when you do that, when you exponentiate alpha times the sigma matrix, and the sigma matrix is traceless, then the determinant of this is going to be 1. And this means that the volume spanned by a basis of vectors stays the same under the action of sigma, because that's what the change in volume would be. And you know that, for example, from the Jacobi determinant when you change variables in an integral. So what that means is that the traceless part can lengthen and shorten eta vectors. So for example, one eta vector might point to, and this is one of our geodesics, one eta vector might point into this direction to the next geodesic, another one eta vector points in this direction to the next geodesic. And if one of them gets longer, the other one has to get shorter, because the overall volume spanned has to remain the same. So what that means is that the sigma matrix can turn a sphere into an ellipsoid, but it will not change actually the volume of it. It's always, if you compress in one direction, it's at the expense of expansion in the other direction. Sigma mu nu is therefore called a shear tensor. Again, that's not what we're really after. We just want to separate it off, because what we're really interested in is this expansion tensor. So while the twist and the shear tensors are both traceless and therefore volume preserving, the trace part sigma, namely this tensor here, 1/3 theta h mu nu, the expansion tensor, is generating by exponentiation a spatial expansion or contraction of nearby geodesics. Exactly, because it will affect that determinant. Now, and you know, when I speak here of expansion and ellipsoids and so on, remember that because the h mu nu is in all of the definitions there, this is really always space-like. This is always actually a rotation. It's never part of, there is no contamination in the sense that it could be partially a Lorentz transformation that's like a boost. It's not about boost, it's actual literal rotations. Okay, so now that we have a definition for the theta, how does theta behave along a geodesic? So again, we have this congruence of geodesics as before, and what we're interested in is not how much these geodesics might rotate around each other, or if we have a circle of geodesics, whether that circle over time gets smaller or larger. What we're interested in is whether it gets smaller or larger, but not whether it's deformed into an ellipse. So we're interested in this one. Now remember that if the strong energy condition holds, then our singularity theorem claimed that the geodesics meet the divergence of the so-called expansion in a finite proper time. So the claim is that under the conditions of the singularity theorem, even if we can't solve the Einstein equations explicitly, even if all we know is only that the Einstein equations hold and that the conditions of the singularity theorem hold, then the claim is that we can prove that if we go along the geodesic, either to the future or to the past, let's say to the past, then we find that the theta actually explodes at a finite proper time in the past, which means that any observer, every observer there on any one of these geodesics can have only a finite age. Because if you go sufficiently far back, the theta actually diverges. So, again, we consider the expansion, and for the specific case of having a congruence of time-like geodesics through a space-like hypersurface sigma, so we have a smooth family of time-like geodesics, exactly one of these geodesics through one of each points of the space-like hypersurface. And I'm just trying to remind you here of the general setup. We consider a one-parameter family of these geodesics, and they are parameterized by this number s. So we have that xi is the vector field d by d tau, and eta is the vector field d by d eta. D by ds, eta is d by ds. So eta is the so-called deviation vector. And the singularity theorem claims now that this, deviation vector, if we go back in time, we will find that the deviation vector gets smaller and smaller, eventually actually hits zero, and forward in time it's actually explosive, because the rate of growth is actually infinite initially. They are not harmlessly meeting. Even that would be sufficient to prove a singularity, but it's actually in a diverging way. So that's what we want to show. So we were asking, how does eta change along a path-directed geodesic with along the tangent of the tangent field xi of a geodesic. For this, we calculated that the covariant derivative of eta, the deviation field in the xi direction, is given by this expression here, where b was defined as that, and b we decomposed into the antisymmetric part, and then the symmetric traceless and the symmetric traceful part. Namely, in this way. And explicitly, we had that the antisymmetric part is given here. The symmetric part is this, and we subtract the trace, and then the traceful part alone is this part. The here, the expansion is defined to be the trace of the B tensor, and the projector onto the directions orthogonal to the geodesic is this projector, if you remember. Okay, so the expansion is the trace of B, and it is calculable either by contracting the B with G or by contracting the B with H. That came out to be the same. So now, what is the dynamics of the expansion theta along a geodesic? Now, so the Reid-Chaudhry equation, right? Reid-Chaudhry, great. Okay, so we need this one now. For our calculations, we will need three ingredients multiple times. First, we will use the definition of the matrix B, of the tensor B, namely as the covariant derivative of xi, of the tangent, xi is the tangent vector field to the geodesics, and that's the covariant derivative of it. And then we remember the Ricci equation. Remember, the Ricci equation tells us that if we take a vector field and covariantly differentiate it twice, and then do the same but in the opposite direction, then that's equal to the Riemann curvature tensor applied to that vector field. Remember, that came up when we proved that What curvature means is that whether I first parallel transport in the direction of the first vector and then the second vector of the parallelogram or the other direction, there is going to be a mismatch of the parallel transported vector, and that's given by the Riemann curvature tensor, and this is what that this is what came up with it. And third, that's statement C that we will need later, xi is the tangent to a geodesic, which means that it obeys the fact that it obeys the condition of being autoparallel. So the covariant derivative of a tangent vector to a geodesic in the direction of the tangent vector to a geodesic is zero, because the geodesic is defined to be, one way to define a geodesic is to say that it is a path such that the tangent vector is parallel transported along that path. That's if you want to define a geodesic through the affine connection. Remember, you could also define a geodesic through the metric. In that case, you would describe it as a path of extremal length. And in the absence of torsion, the two are the same. Now, let's spell this out. This condition is that the covariant derivative of the xi vector field in the xi vector field spelled out as coefficient functions times basis vectors is zero. That's this condition here. Then we know, we remember that we can always pull these coefficients in front of the covariant derivative. So we have this, and then that gives us two terms when applied to that by the product rule, the ordinary derivative of the xi and the Christoffel symbol for the covariant derivative of the basis vector, both of which are captured by saying we take these, the semicolon of that. And that means this the fact that xi is a tangent vector field means this. I mean, this is just to say that xi parallel transported in its own direction is vanishing. So now, using ABC, we can calculate the rate of change of eta along the geodesic. I mean, we can calculate how eta changes along the geodesic. But what we really want is, of course, the contraction of B with G min U. So what we do is we start by calculating the covariant derivative of the full B in the direction of the tangent to the geodesic. So we calculate the covariant derivative of the full matrix B in the xi direction. That's this. Then we use the definition of B to write this out in this way. So it's the covariant derivative of the covariant derivative. It's the second covariant derivative of xi here. And now we use the fact that the covariant derivative in the direction of B and C can also be written as the sum of two terms, namely this term plus that term. You can throw this one on the other side. And that's what we do. So we can now write this expression as that expression plus that. And now that term we can write down as the result of the covariant differentiation of this term. Right? So we take this term and covariantly differentiate with respect to B. That gives us this term. But of course, we also get another term now, where we have the covariant derivative in the B direction of xi xi. That term wasn't up here, so we have to subtract it. So that's a term that we obtained by subtracting that, and this is just being carried forward. Now, this expression is by that property vanishing, right? Because of xi being the tangent to a geodesic. And so therefore, we only have these two terms surviving. This term is vanishing. We just have these two terms surviving. And what we notice here is that this is the B matrix again, and that's the B matrix again. And this is just being carried forward. So the covariant derivative of the B matrix or the B tensor is just the square of the B tensor. And then we have this curvature part. So far, in summary, what we derived is that covariant derivative of B is given by this term plus that term. I just carried this forward. And remember that what we really need is just a trace of it. What we need is the trace of this. You might say, okay, but if we take the trace of B, then we get a G mu nu, and then we have another covariant differentiation. But that's trivial, because the covariant derivative of G is vanishing. So what we need now is the trace of the B mu nu. That's the expansion. Okay, so all right, this is what we have. But now, before we take the trace of this equation, let us remember that the xi vector field, the tangents to the geodesics, is d by d tau, tau being the proper time of the geodesics. And the trace of B is what we get when we contract the B tensor with G mu nu. And that's theta. That's the thing that we want. So now what we do is we take the trace of that equation. Now the left-hand side of this is what here? If we take the trace of this, then we just have the d by d tau of the contraction of B. So it's just d by d tau of theta. Now on the right-hand side, on the other hand, we have the trace of all of this. But the B mu nu, we decomposed, and we can use the decomposition. Now remember, we had it decomposed into three terms: antisymmetric, symmetric traceless, symmetric traceful. And we need to take the square of it, so correspondingly we get nine terms. We have, these are the three terms that are in that B, and then these are the three terms that are in that B. So overall we get nine terms. However, because of the antisymmetry and the symmetry and the tracelessness, we have that undertaking the trace, actually only this term survives on the first line, that term survives on the second line, and that term survives on the third line. All the other terms cancel out. So that means that the trace of this term, and remember, we need the trace of this term and we need the trace of that term, but first we're working on the trace of this term. So in order to get the trace of the square of B, we had to pick up these three terms. And these three terms are those three terms. I mean, those underlined terms. These are the ones that survive here. And notice that we get a 1/3 and a 1/3 here, that gives us a 1/9. But then also we will have to contract this h with that h. And that's a projector that's space-like, and you take the trace of that, you end up adding up 1 plus 1 plus 1 for each of the spatial directions. So the contraction of h with itself gives us just a 3, and that means that we have here a 3 divided by the 9th, so overall we are left with a 1/3. So the Rai-Chaudhry equation is the trace of this. And we saw that on the left-hand side, we just have the time derivative of the expansion. So we have the time derivative of the expansion is equal to, and then we have with a negative all those terms. So in particular, we have the negative of the antisymmetric term. Here it is. We have the negative of the symmetric term here. There it is. And we have the negative of that term. Remember, that's a 1/3. So we have minus 1/3 theta squared as well. And we have this term here. Now, the question is whether that term here is positive or negative. I mean, first of all, let me mention that this is a square, so that's negative. That's a square, so that's negative. And that's a square, so that's negative. But what about this term? And this is where the strong energy condition comes in. In principle, we don't know whether this thing is positive or negative. Ultimately, we are interested in what is the derivative of this. Is it positive or negative? Is the space-time, I mean, are the geodesics expanding or shrinking or neither? Right? We want to put a bound there. And it depends on that. But you see, what is that? We can write in, using the Einstein equation, we can write the Ricci tensor. If the space-time has 3+1 dimensions, we can write the Ricci tensor as the energy-momentum tensor minus 1/2 gt mu, right? Because remember that the Einstein equation in 3+1 dimensions can also equivalently be written mu nu is equal to some coupling constant that I don't remember exactly what it is. It's some nu or whatever. And then you have t mu nu minus 1/2 T alpha G mu nu, right? And so you see that to require that this has a particular sign is to require that the strong energy condition holds. So that's the original motivation for why we might ask the strong energy condition to hold. What's also interesting is that it's the same condition that requires that the W parameter is larger than minus a third, which is to say that there shouldn't be any deceleration, right, or acceleration, depending on whether you look at it forward or backward in time. Which is plausible, right? Because if the universe shrinks towards the past, but the shrinkage is actually slowing down as you go to the past, then it might never shrink to a point. Okay, so now let's consider the dynamics. We have, we want to assume that R mu nu, psi mu, psi nu is larger or equal to zero for all time like psi. And that means using the Einstein equation that we're assuming that this condition holds and that is the strong energy condition. So if we assume the strong energy condition, then we have that d theta by d tau, and then we bring this on the other side, so plus 1/3 theta squared is smaller equal to zero. Let me see. What did I do here? Or is it positive? Did I get the sign wrong here?
Everything on the right side is negative.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, everything is negative. You're right. Sorry. yes, exactly. So it's fine. Okay, good. So now we can divide this by theta squared, that equation. And it will not change the sign here because the theta squared is positive. So we can write here 1 over theta squared d theta by d tau is minus a third is larger or equal to 0. And we've multiplied the entire equation with a minus 1, and that flipped the sign, flipped the inequality, because we multiplied the whole equation with a minus 1. And now we can express this as d by d tau of theta inverse, right? Because if you take d by d tau of theta inverse, then that is minus 1 over theta squared times d by d theta, just by the chain rule. This is the same as that. And now we bring this 1/3 on the other side, we have this. So, an explosion means theta diverges. It means that theta inverse goes to zero. So what we are looking for is zero crossings of theta. Okay, so d by d tau is, of course, the derivative, the rate of change of theta as we go along a geodesic. Now, there are two cases that we can consider. One of them is where the geodesics are initially either all diverging, that would be our universe. The geodesics are diverging because the space-time is expanding. So we have the case where at time t naught, which is now, for example, the theta is positive. So they're all diverging. On the other hand, we can also consider the situation of a recollapse, where the universe, for example, has expanded for a while and now it's recollapsing. And in that case, we would be in a situation now, T0, where, you know, the universe is collapsing onto itself and we are wondering, is it going to end in a big crunch singularity or not? We can cover both cases with the same theorem here. Okay, so then we have the following picture. Pressed once too much. Okay, so we have this equation here. We have that the tau derivative of theta inverse is larger or equal to a third. Now, in the first case, that's the case we're interested in. That's the present universe. Let's say tau naught is now, and we have that the universe is expanding everywhere. The extrinsic curvature is positive. The universe is expanding. So it's diverging, expanding universe. We are interested in the question, was there a singularity in the past? And here's the picture that we have in this case. So what we have is that at time t0, or tau 0, that's our time now, for example, we have that theta inverse is positive. So theta inverse is positive at some point here. And now we know that that's theta inverse, right? So theta is positive, so theta inverse is positive. We also know that the derivative of theta inverse at all times is larger or equal to a third, right? So it means that if we draw here a line, a straight line of slope 1/3, it means in particular that if we plot theta inverse as a function of proper time, we are interested in the past, right? If we plot theta inverse as a function of time, then it must be intersecting that line of a 1/3 with a slope that's larger than a third, right? Because the slope is larger than a third. So we know this much. But we know that the slope has to be larger than a third at all times, especially in the past. Right? So if we now want to plot the theta inverse as a function of tau, we know we start here. We know the slope is steeper than a third. And we know that the slope has always been steeper than a third. But if the slope has always been steeper than a third, then this curve has always been pointing to a point that's closer than this, right? So it's something like that. It could also be like this. Could also be like that, but in order to never hit the x-axis, you know, the curve would have to go like this, but then now the slope is smaller than a third. So it cannot do that, right? If the curve theta inverse of tau was to always avoid hitting the axis, well, then it would have to have at some point a slope that's shallower than a third. Any curve that has always a slope higher than a third will hit, well, if it has the slope exactly equal to a third, then the curve would hit the x-axis here. Otherwise, if it has a steeper slope, and it does have a steeper slope because it's actually larger equal to, and we know that the extra terms that contribute, then it will actually hit here. Except if there's a cosmological constant, right? Then the strong energy condition wouldn't hold. This term with the curvature in it could flip the sign. And therefore, that inequality wouldn't hold anymore, and you could have that sort of thing. But as long as the strong energy condition holds, we are bounded by a third, and this curve has to hit the x-axis somewhere. But what that means is that theta inverse goes to zero, which means that theta itself goes to infinity. So the rate at which geodesics diverge from another goes to infinity at a finite amount of proper time in the past. And similarly, we can consider the case where now, for example, the universe was recollapsing. And we have that the expansion is negative everywhere, I mean on our space-like hypersurface, and we have the strong energy condition fulfilled. In this case, the theta inverse and the theta are negative to start with. And so the theta is somewhere here. And now we have the one-third slope curve is going here, right? So, and we also have, again, this equation. So the theta, the slope of that theta inverse curve has to be larger than a third. So our curve always has to have a slope that's steeper than this, which means that if we now go further and further into the future, the theta inverse must hit that axis at some point, which means theta diverges there. So at the finite time in the future, the theta will hit infinity. So that means that we have a big crunch in the past, because in the future, right? Because we are looking to the future in this case and see the future singularity there. So the conclusion is, out of time, the conclusion is that this equation here, which is essentially the Rajchaudhuri equation, it implies that theta inverse must go through zero at a finite amount of proper time for every geodesic of our collection of geodesics. So for sufficiently, in the case A, so expanding universe, for sufficiently early proper time, we have that the expansion goes to infinity. So not only do we have a singularity, but the expansion actually starts with a huge bang because it's an infinite expansion at the beginning, big bang. Or in the case of the big crunch scenario, we have that at the sufficiently late time, but finite time in the future, and we can put a bound on how late that can be because of the one-third, we have that the expansion goes to minus infinity, so we have the big crunch. Because remember that the expansion here is negative, so it diverges, so it doesn't go to infinity, it goes to negative infinity in the big crunch. So this type of reasoning also leads to other cosmological singularity theorems. And there are weaker versions, versions with weaker conditions, for example, not assuming global hyperbolicity. And then, accordingly, the conclusion is weaker. In that case, one can prove that at least one incomplete geodesic, time-like geodesic exists, which means that, yes, there is going to be a singularity, but in principle, you're not showing that, for example, in the case of a Big Bang singularity, you're not showing that every observer had in its past the singularity. You just show that some observers had that. But of course, you still have a Big Bang there. Okay, right, that's as far as we got today.